It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we've all heard the basics of how life evolved over billions of years on Earth, how ancient fish evolved from the waters of our planet to walk on land, how reptiles transformed into birds that fly, how our primate ancestors, our ancestors, evolved into Homo sapien, humans that walk on two legs, talk and write, and listen to Iowa Public Radio. My guest is best-selling author and biologist Neil Shubin. His latest book is titled Some Assembly Required, Decoding 4 Billion Years of Life from Ancient Fossils to DNA. In it, Shubin offers a new view of evolution that explains how the incredible diversity of life on our planet came to be. He is the Robert R. Bensley Professor of Organismal Biology and Anatomy at the University of Chicago. His previous books include The Universe Within and Your Inner Fish. That one was chosen by the National Academy of Sciences as the best book of the year in 2009. What a great honor and pleasure to have you on our program, Neil Shubin.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Let's start off. I want to quote a little bit from the prologue of your book. You write, "If you think feathers arose to help animals fly, or lungs and legs to help animals walk on land, you'd be in good company. You'd also be entirely wrong." Explain why we would be wrong.
Yeah, you know, so we have this view in evolution. We've had this view in evolution that, you know, somehow you have to, when these great revolutions in the history of life happen, like when fish evolved to take the first steps on land, let's just look at that for example. We know at about 375, 380 million years ago, you know, life made the shift from water to land. Before that point, you know, there were fish living in water, but really kind of nothing but plants and invertebrate animals on land. Then at some point, our distant ancestors started to take those first steps. Well, you know, you'd naively think that, you know, legs and lungs and fingers and toes and all these things that critters use to walk on land, that they were necessary inventions that arose at that point. Well, the more we look, the more we find that that's just simply not true. That is, lungs arose well before, eons before, fish ever took their first steps on land. Limbs with, you know, arm bones, elbows, wrists, and stubby fingers arose well before fish ever walked on land. The descendants of fish. And we see that in the fossil record. We see that in the genome. And, you know, it's remarkable. You go and look at diverse fish, and pretty much all fish have some sort of air sac that lies adjacent to the gut tube. In a lot of fish, it's a lung. There are lung fish. There are other fish that have lungs. They have both lungs and gills. They use both of them to breathe. They'll use the gills to breathe in water when there's lots of oxygen content is high in the water. They'll use the lungs when the oxygen content decreases, and they'll just go to the surface and breathe air. That strategy was around for eons before fish took their first steps on land. So the key take-home message is that you don't as much need new inventions to do new things in evolution. It's using old inventions in new ways, using the old to make the new. It's repurposing. It's tinkering. And that kind of tinkering has led to some great revolutionary changes in the history of life on our planet.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so walk us through then step by step, because I'm not sure you've completely exploded my myth and the myth of many others about how sea creatures came to the land. What would be the steps then if they didn't sort of develop legs out of flippers to walk on land?
Well, they did. So let me just give you, so basically my team and I, working in the Canadian Arctic, we're working on rocks about 375, 380 million years old, and we discovered, and we were looking for it, we discovered a fish with fins, with scales, with fish-like bones, but it also had limb bones inside the fin. It had a humerus, that is, upper arm, a radius. I mean, it had an upper arm, forearm, even parts of a wrist. It had lungs and gills. And so when you look at this, what you have are a bunch of fish, say 390, 375 million years ago, who were living in shallow streams, walking on water bottoms, living in the shallows, were able to use lungs and gills, were supporting themselves with their arm bones, doing a form of push-up, which is what these ancient fossils can do. And it turns out that when you have that sort of system, you already have a creature that's able to live on land when it needs to. And the question is, you know, it's not necessarily evolving new structures, but it's basically using those new old structures in new ways when they need to. Mm. And so if you were to look at those streams 375 million years ago, It was a pretty harsh environment. There are, you know, all kinds of carnivorous fish, and land was loaded with food, invertebrates and plants and so forth, but no competitors. So there came a moment when all those inventions that were really great for living in certain kinds of water environments became useful for life on land. So the shift is really kind of not the origin of new stuff. It's using old stuff in new ways when the opportunity arises.
Okay. Neil, let's address the other sort of complex and evolutionary question that you tackle in this book. How organisms bearing no immediately perceptible resemblance to each other, dinosaurs and birds can be closely related. So there we have the other real puzzling thing. How did birds evolve from reptiles? They couldn't be more different when we look at them today, could they?
No, when you look at them today, you know, you look at a crocodile and you look at a bird, they look extremely different. But when you go to the fossil record, all of a sudden you start to bridge those gaps. See, that's why I love being a paleontologist, honestly. You know, I mean, it's like you see the world today, then when you crack rocks, you start to see what the world looked like hundreds of millions of years ago. And, you know, you look at that and you say birds have feathers, and nothing else has feathers. Birds use those feathers to fly. So obviously feathers arose to help birds fly. Well, the story's a lot like lungs. No, sorry, the feathers arose well before. That is, if we look at theropod dinosaurs, carnivorous dinosaurs, what you find is they get very, 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 underline very, bird-like. They have a bird-like wrist. They have bird-like arms. They have bird-like hollow bones. They have air sacs that look something like they like a bird-like lung. And importantly, the fossils are revealing that many of these dinosaurs, in fact, most of them, had feathers. So feathers we first see in the fossil record, not in birds, but we see them in dinosaurs. And we see them in the most bird-like of all dinosaurs, the theropod dinosaurs. And these are dinosaurs that had extremely high metabolisms. We know that when we look at the cellular structure of their fossils, their bones. We know they had feathers. We know they had that they were able to run very fast, high activity lifestyles, much like birds today. So these dinosaurs were approaching a bird-like form. And yet they weren't capable of flight. Flight, we believe, arose as there are a couple different scenarios. There are a couple different ideas that are out there. One is that as animals became faster and faster, taking ever greater leaps, that they would be able to take off from the ground. A proto-feather would enable them to take ever-increasing leaps off the ground. Mm. Others view it as their relationship with that maybe that these dinosaurs were running up and down trees, and that they were able to, you know, go from heights when they were in the trees and things like that. But with either scenario, the one fact that we have is that the fossil record shows that a bird-like anatomy first appears in dinosaurs, and that includes feathers. And so the history of feathers is shifting their function from the function they had in dinosaurs, which may be, you know, sexual displays, thermoregulation, insulation, that kind of thing, to flight. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's not like feathers had to be an invention to help animals fly. Feathers, like lungs, well before in the history of life, were already around and repurposed.
So in this repurposing, to go along with sort of, I guess, Darwin's theories and evolution, so this increased ability to hop because they could gain advantage through these early feathers or perhaps come from a tree, mm-hmm. fall down from a tree, that gave them an advantage, and that's how sort of birds exploded, the species of birds exploded?
That's correct. Yes, that's correct. So either one of those scenarios would bring about the same result, which is a lineage that can fly. And there's a whole, when you can fly, there's a whole new world that's open for you. It's just like when creatures took those first steps on land. Same thing. A whole new world opens up and, you know, their descendants just take over.
My guest, if you just joined us, is author and biologist Neil Shubin. Some Assembly Required, his book, Decoding 4 Billion Years of Life from Ancient Fossil to DNA. A central question you address in your book, Neil, is how do these large changes in history of life come about? So when we throw in DNA, what is new? How have we coupled our technology to explore DNA with these prehistoric fossils?
You know, oh my gosh, our world has changed so much in the last few decades because of the revolution in genomic technology. It's really remarkable. You know, we've had, you know, the Human Genome Project. We all remember when that was published. But since that time, we've had thousands upon thousands of genome projects where we now have the genomes of microbes, viruses, bacteria, flies, fish, worms, people of different kinds. I mean, we just have just so many different kinds of genomes. We are now able to ask the question, and compare the genomes of two kinds of animals and say, what at the genetic level makes them different? Mm-hmm. You know, we can begin to probe that. That's just amazing. What are the list of genes that make a chimpanzee different from a person, or a person different from a fish? We can now access that at the level of DNA. And that is really has been full of surprises. You know, for a long period of time, our window into the history of life, where, you know, anatomy and fossils, things like that, now we have this whole new record that is just not only revealing us what the similarities and differences at the genetic level among species, but also, you know, what drives those differences? What makes them different? You know, and so we can get to so many questions that were not accessible to us before. And that's why in the book I try to weave together our approaches from fossils with those from genomes, because together they tell us some important facts.
Mm-hmm. Does DNA survive in any of these really old fossils?
Not the really old ones, no. And we have DNA of some old fossils, but it's not like the level of, say, dinosaur DNA or some of the fish that walked on land DNA. What we can do, though, is we can do this. Let me give you one experiment, mm-hmm. set of experiments that my lab did. We can look at the DNA that builds, say, an organ in people and mice, something like that. So we can ask the question, what DNA is active when our limbs are forming, when our fingers and toes form, and you know, from egg to adult? You know, we start as a single cell, a fertilized egg. You and I and your listeners are 4 trillion cells sitting here. So somehow we go from a single cell to 4 trillion cells, and in the process, our organs are built, our bodies are built, our tissues are built, and that comes about by DNA being turned on and off to make these different organs. Well, we can ask the question then is, okay, well, the genetic recipe that builds a hand and an arm of people, is that present in other creatures living today? And what are the similarities and differences? Well, it turns out that the genetic recipe that builds our arms and legs is very similar to that builds the arms and legs of mice. No surprise there, probably. There are subtle differences, but they are subtle. And we can trace that deeper and deeper and deeper still. It turns out that fish have those genes too, and those genes are active as fish make their fins. And it turns out the genes that sculpt our wrists and digits, okay, are present in fish. And what are they doing? They're making the terminal end of fish fins. You know, so we can modify. I could take the genes from a fish that makes the terminal end of their fish fin, right? And I can put it in a mice. This is the technologies we have now. We can pop it in a mouse and ask what it does. And guess what it does? It's making the terminal end of a mouse limb. You know, so we can swap the genes between species.
Wow.
Take a mouse gene and put it in a fish, put a fish gene inside a mouse. This is the technology we have. And we can begin to ask the question, what's the fish gene doing in the mouse context, and vice versa? Well, guess what? In a lot of these things, it turns out the fish kind of knows its way around the mouse genome, the fish genome. And the only reason for that is we have this deep similarity of the of many of the important toolkit pieces, genes, that build bodies. It's already there. And so a lot of evolution, again, is repurposing. Like we talked about repurposing with, you know, feathers and lungs, but we see it at a genetic level too. A lot of, you know, evolution is not necessarily, there's some of this in, you know, the origin of new genes, but also it's repurposing, using old genes in new ways. So the fish fin genes were repurposed to make hands and feet. Let's put it that way.
Neil Shubin is my guest. Some Assembly Required, his latest book. Here's a part of your book that I have to bring up, especially in the current context of the corona outbreak. You point out that our genome is full of ancient viruses that invaded our DNA. That doesn't sound like a good thing at all, Neil, but explain the part they play in making us who we are. I think your example in the book is memory, right?
Yeah, now this is true. I mean, I use the term mind-blowing, but yeah, for a memory gene, I'm sorry about that. But it really is, because if you look at our genome, only 2% of our entire genome contains our genes, the sections that, you know, encode for proteins. The rest of that 98% is just a lot of other stuff that is important, but has other more complex activities. Turns out when we mine our genome, when we look at the sequence, it turns out that 8% of our genome consists of ancient viruses that invaded the genomes of our distant ancestors, only to be knocked out, only to be rendered, you know, neutered, useless. So we have 4 times more viral genetic material inside our own DNA than our own genes. And when scientists from the University of Utah started to look at, they weren't virologists, they were just like studying memory, they found a memory gene called ARC, A-R-C. They were looking at ARC and how it plays a role in memory. It's a very important gene in humans, and in fact, some neurodegenerative diseases are related to, you know, changes in the activity of ARC, this gene. So they, you know, like any good scientist, they wanted to look at the genetic structure of this gene and the proteins it makes. They were like taking it apart at the molecular level, and they were in for a huge, huge surprise. And the surprise was, the more they looked at the protein structure and the way that ARC works to in memory, it's functioning as a virus. That is, it is a modified virus that this this gene, so important for memory, is actually a modified virus that invaded the genome of our distant ancestors eons ago, and then itself was put to use. It was repurposed by those ancient genomes to play a role in memory.
That's amazing. How long have we known that?
Two, 3 years, something like that. It's pretty new. You know, wow. 2 years was when the paper was published. Yes, it's all pretty new. And there are other genes, like in the placenta, you know, obviously very so important in reproduction. Those also have a viral origin as well. So, you know, if you look at the history of life, it's really been this, you know, balance, this interaction between, you know, bodies and genomes and viruses. And viruses are continually invading. In most cases, they're kind of neutral in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
They invade the genome only to get knocked out. In other cases, they can be quite devastating. You know, they can wreak havoc on the world, as we're witnessing now. But still other times they invade and then they become fuel for evolution, you know, which is, that's a whole new story.
This
is just all new stuff. And that's kind of, when I was reading the scientific literature, about this stuff, I was thinking, gosh, you know, this is just amazing science. We're living in a great age of science. And I wanted to tell those stories.
Mm-hmm. In this book, Neil Shubin, you write about many different scientists. You trace over centuries the understanding of our evolution here, taking on such topics as genetic alterations, mutations. But these are very interesting scientists, natural philosophers, researchers. Tell us about one that perhaps is a favorite of yours, a person perhaps had some personal habits, or you are a scientist, so you must feel really attached to a lot of these people.
One of the joys of writing a book like this is I do sort of a deep dive into these people, some of whom have been unheralded, but who lived these incredible lives of discovery, just trying to learn about our world. And one of them, one of my favorites, there's so many, but the one I tell in the book, who I just actually, you know, just warmed my heart, was this woman by the name of Julia Platt. Julia Platt went to the University of Vermont, and she wanted to become a biologist. So she started to study, after graduating from Vermont, she wanted to study development, you know, the process by which, you know, you go from an egg to an adult to understand how bodies are built. And, you know, this is the mid-1800s, and there was no room for women in science. So she went to Germany and got a PhD in Germany, where the environment was a little more fruitful, and then came back to the United States and started to do work in Massachusetts at the marine station, studying salamanders and sharks and so forth. And she did her thing, and she discovered something that really didn't make sense to a lot of people. She discovered that the development of our head, really big parts of our head, relied on a whole different kind of cell that people did not expect before. It was sort of an esoteric discovery. She made this esoteric discovery about the cell type that gave rise to heads. But people didn't disagree. People disagree with her so strongly that she had to leave the field. So she made this big discovery. No one believed her. One person did, but that wasn't enough. She ended up writing then the president of Stanford University in the late 1800s, saying, "Look, I did this work, and I can't get a job. I'm gonna have to leave science if I can't get a job anywhere." And she ended up leaving science and moving to Pacific Grove, California, never to do scientific research again. But she was just an amazing human being. She ended up getting elected mayor of Pacific Grove. And then ended up leading an effort to save Monterey Bay. All right, so there's an amazing person who would not be stopped. And it turned out that after she died, saving Monterey Bay, Mayor Pacific Grove, that discovery she made, that seemingly esoteric discovery, it turned out to be fundamental, because other people then confirmed it and extended it to show that many of the organs in our body as we compare ourselves to other creatures, came about as the result of a new kind of cell, that you can trace all these complex evolutionary changes to our bodies to one cell type that arose in the distant past. So it's not like there were hundreds of different changes that happened that had to happen independently of our body. It meant really just kind of one thing, a new kind of cell. And so she showed an important pathway which evolution and development and embryology likely happened, and in a remarkable life story. You know, so I did a deep dive into her life, and there are others like it. And I just, you know, just being able to write about that is such a privilege to me.
Wow. Author and biologist Neil Shubin has been with us for this portion of the program. Neil, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Some Assembly Required is Neil's book, Decoding 4 Billion Years of Life from Ancient Fossils to DNA. And that's it for this hour. Tomorrow on River to River, analysis of the political fallout from the coronavirus pandemic. My guests on Politics Wednesday, Rachel Caulfield of Drake University and Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. Also, of course, we'll look at what the primary results from Arizona, Florida, and Illinois mean for the Democratic primary. That's tomorrow on River to River Politics Wednesday. Remember, you can find out the latest on the COVID-19 epidemic and ask your question about this national health emergency by following our live blog at iowapublicradio.org. River to River is also available as a podcast. Just subscribe to River to River using your favorite podcast app or go to iowapublicradio.org. Find River to River. It's a great way not to miss River to River if you happen to be busy during the noon hour on certain days. Also a good way to share our discussions with other people. Find River to River at iowapublicradio.org. River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop, Rick Brewer, and Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.